As we discussed the Megillah today, what I'm essentially going to do is focus on two ideas which are in this book. This book is put out, it's called Hadassah Hi Esther, which is a quote from the Megillah. When we're first introduced to Esther, we're first introduced to Mordechai, who was taking care of Esther, and the Megillah tells us, "Vayhi omein es Hadassah Hi Esther bas Dodo." And he was watching over Hadassah, who is also to be known as Esther for the rest of the Megillah. So this book was put together almost 15 years ago. It's a Sefer Zikaron Hadassah Esther Rabinovich, a young lady who unfortunately died on account of cancer. So the book is dedicated in her memory. It's divided into three sections. The first section has a Megillah, which was written in her memory, so it's a copy of it. And then there are a number of articles which were written, some for this publication, some for other publications, but they were compiled together here. And the last section is about her, and it has letters that she wrote or that were written to her, and journal entries and articles that appeared about her in the paper. She apparently became a big symbol in Israel in the war against cancer, and so after she passed away, this book was made in her memory. So there are many articles in there, but I'm going to be addressing two of the thoughts which are related from an article written by Rabbi Yaakov Maidan, who is now one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshivat Har Etzion, the Gush Yeshiva. The other one is Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun, who wears many hats in the education world in Israel, and the related ideas, you'll see how they come together as we go through. I don't know how much we'll actually be looking inside the Megillah, but if you want to check up on anything which I say, like, hey, that doesn't sound right, or prove that, so you can certainly look it up. So the Megillah is on page 1252.
Got time before Lisa comes.
Right, Megillah is on page 1252 in the Rosh Chumash. If you're looking for where it is, and we'll begin now. So Rabbi Yaakov Maidan has an article, in his article, which is entitled "Mordechai Lo Yichrav Lo Yishtachaveh." Mordechai does not bow to Haman, and then the last line of his title is "Madua," and why? How come Mordechai isn't bowing down to Haman? So in the Midrash, you know, that's essentially what we have. The most elaborate answers. The Megillah gives us one answer. Okay, Haman asks everybody, "How come Mordechai is not bowing down to him?" And the Megillah tells us, "Ki yigid lahem asher hu Yehudi." Right? The reason why he's not bowing down is because he's a Jew. Okay, but the Midrash has different approaches to why Mordechai wasn't bowing down. The first two are the ones which are probably more well known, and that is that Haman had embroidered on his shirt, or he was wearing some sort of idolatrous image, and he was having people bow down to that as well. And Mordechai did not want to do that. The other one is that Haman essentially made himself into a deity-like individual. He viewed himself as above everyone else, not just as a human, but as something really special. And Mordechai did not want to give him that credit. The third approach is one which is also known. You probably heard somewhere along the way that it was more of a personal vendetta between Mordechai and Haman, that they had a history, right? They had been soldiers in the army, or they were on a ship once, or they were in the desert, and Haman was in the need of either food or supplies or whatever it may have been, and Mordechai had them and sold them to Haman in exchange for Haman's servitude. So as a result, when Haman's walking around, he may be Mr. High and Mighty in Achashverosh's eyes, but in Mordechai's eyes, their common history has made Haman his slave for life. You know, much like Yaakov and Esav had their initial transaction, where Yaakov says to Esav, "Give me your birthright for the food which I'm going to give you." "Well, I'm going to die anyway, so what do I need it for?" "Okay, fine, so sell it to me." "Okay, I sell it to you." So it doesn't matter what the rest of their life may turn out. The bottom line is that Esav made a sale, and that sale is presumably binding. Even if it was made under duress, he could have said, "Get lost. I'm not buying this. I mean, I could go get some other food." He could have, because it doesn't seem like, after he ate the food that Yaakov gave him, that he needed to rest, needed to feel better. He got up and walked out, quickly. So if Esav acts in that way, it seems that certainly he wasn't put under major duress in terms of making such an agreement. So similarly, Haman. I mean, maybe he was under duress, but it doesn't matter. Once you make a deal like that, then you know, you could say the terms aren't fair. Terms aren't fair. Fine. So get lost. You know, go find something else. Go find someone else to supply you. This is what I'm willing to give you in exchange for what I'm asking for. Okay. Now, Rav Medan goes into a whole, what they call in Hebrew, an arichos, right? He lengthy commentary in which he tries to understand, you know, if it's in fact a problem to bow down to Mordechai under the circumstances that I just described, leaving out the last one that, you know, that Haman is Mordechai's servant. But if Haman is either representing himself as an idol, or on his clothing or what he's wearing, he bears an idol, is Mordechai not allowed to bow? And he compares it to the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Those are the colleagues / friends of Daniel in the book of Daniel, who were instructed by the king Nebuchadnezzar to bow down to an image of Nebuchadnezzar, and bow down to the king, and they refused. And the question is, were they in the right? Did they have to go so far? Was it considered an idolatrous practice? I mean, the truth of the matter is that bowing down to a human being is not considered a problem in the Torah. First, you may bow down to a human being, not to worship the person, but as a form of obedience or subservience, it's okay. It's permissible according to the Torah. What's not permissible is bowing down to an idol. So if Haman viewed himself as a deity, as they say, whoop-de-doo, who cares? You know, he can view himself however he wants. The bottom line is he's a human being, and everybody knows that he's a human being. So to bow down to him, is it a problem from a halachic perspective? Most likely not. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, some suggest that they took it to an extreme. Everybody else is bowing down. You don't have to put yourself in danger. It's one thing if a person says to you as an individual, bow down to this idol or I'm going to kill you. And it's a time when you the only way for you to act is in a way which sanctifies God's name. So then the rule is you give yourself up. But in a situation where everybody's doing it and you're not going to be making any message, and you're not going to be getting across that this is the wrong thing to do, and for the sake of God, I'm not going to do it, there is an argument which Rabbi Dan suggests. I don't remember the source, but that it's you know, you can do that. You're not making any bold statement by losing your life when everybody else is doing it anyway. Okay, and if it was an image of Nebuchadnezzar wasn't an idol. He's not something that people worshipped. He's a king, so it's a statue of the king. Is that considered avodah zarah? Is that considered an idol? Very likely not. And because it's not, Nebuchadnezzar is a human being and he's going to die. And once he dies, then what's his statue worth? It's not worth the salt it's made with. But if it's an idol, which people view as something beyond human, then it's a problem. So in that comparison, he says that maybe Mordechai could have bowed down. Okay. But then Rav Medan takes the whole perspective of why Mordechai is not bowing down to a completely different level. Because on the one hand, we could say, like the Midrash, that it had to do with idolatry. On the other hand, we could say, like the Midrash, that it had to do with a personal vendetta. On the other hand, we could look at the Megillah itself and see what's the reason why Mordechai is not bowing down. Right? As I said at the outset, one reason, because ki yigid lahem asher hu yehudim. Mordechai told all the other workers in the servants of the king in the court of the king, the reason why he's not bowing down is because he's a Jew. So what? You know, just because you're a Jew, why don't you explain, elaborate a little more? You know, maybe you can explain that Haman's wearing something on his neck, or I don't bow down to people, or that. But I mean, there's no problem with bowing down in front of a king, so what's the problem? It's just, I'm a Jew, I don't do that. And once you have that, you know, and I'm being vague on purpose, because I'm just trying to build the case, but once you have that as an initial answer, that the reason why you're not doing is because you're a Jew, but you can't explain further, you have to wonder what that means to the individual who's speaking. And then Rav Medan starts to ask questions about Esther and Mordechai vis-a-vis how they're presented in the Megillah. You have Esther, who when she goes to the palace of the king, she readily agrees to Mordechai's request. He says, don't tell anybody, right? Let's, you know, if you want to look at it, it's on the bottom of this... No, I'm sorry. It's the top of the next page. Okay? Pasuk Yud. Lo higida Esther es amaves mulatata ki Mordechai tziva le'Asher lo sagid. Esther doesn't tell anything about her people or her kindred, right, where she comes from, because Mordechai told her not to tell. Now, we always assumed that the reason why that Esther's job as a nice Jewish girl is to go into the palace and not get the job, right? You're a nice Jewish girl, you shouldn't be getting the job. That's why, hey, guy says, take this. She says, no, take this. No, I don't want. I'm not interested in all this fancy schmancy stuff. Right. Now, let's take a step back for a second. If Esther is not supposed to get the job, okay, don't you think it would be a little more appropriate for her to tell everybody, by the way, everybody, my great-grandmother was born in Jerusalem, and I am a nice Jewish girl, and I'm very interested in this position. You know, if you think she walks in like that, and according to one approach, she's even married to Mordechai. Okay, let's leave that out for a second. If she's going to walk in, let's say she walks in with a nice shetel, a nice little tichel, she walks in there, and she says to Achashverosh, hi, I'm a landsman from Poland, and this is where I come from. What do you think Achashverosh is going to say? Next. Right? The fact that she's hiding her identity, the fact that she doesn't tell who she is, the fact that she goes in there and essentially, maybe she sees, everybody who's going in for these 6-month beauty salon is really not getting picked. Maybe Achashverosh looks for a natural beauty. Right? All this stuff is all fake. If I come in here just on my, who I am, just me as a person, maybe that's a better chance. And sure enough, she is chosen. So why does Esther come with that strategy if the goal is not to be picked? Unless the goal is to be picked. Okay? Mordechai. Now, the first time we're introduced to Mordechai, the Megillah tells us, Ish Yehudi haya b'Shoshana Bira. Who's telling us that? The narrator of the Megillah. At what point? After the Megillah has been written. When's the first time in the Megillah we see that Mordechai is presented as a Yehudi? Meaning to other people. Right, the whole
of
time
the
of
people where you've just mentioned.
Right, exactly. In other words, not at the time of the party. The Midrash tells us Mordechai told people to not go to the party. Okay, let's leave it. There's no indication of that here. The party's long gone by the time Mordechai is introduced to us. Right, Vashti's dead, and when we're introduced to Esther, that's when we're, as an aside, introduced to Mordechai in the middle of chapter 2. Okay. Right, the first time that Mordechai is identified as a Jew vis-a-vis other people. We have one more story with Mordechai before Perek Gimel, and that is the story of Mordechai with Bigson and Zeresh, right? Mordechai tells Esther to tell the king, okay? And it's written in the thing that it's written in the king's chronicles that who saved his life? Mordechai. Not Mordechai HaYehudi, Mordechai. Hey, Mordechai. When Esther tells the king, we would assume at that point in time the cat's out of the bag, right? Esther has a relationship with Mordechai. Why is she getting intimate information? Close, important information being told to Esther? Why doesn't Mordechai come straight to the king? Well, because his real in to the king is Esther. Well, how does that happen? Is it just Esther that you have you've picked certain royal officers which are your confidants? But even so, there's no connection made that identifies either one of them as a Yehudi at that point in time. The first time we hear that Mordechai is a Yehudi is when Haman says, how come Mordechai is not bowing down? Ki yigid lahem asher hu Yehudi. That's the first time that we see Mordechai vis-a-vis other people as understood to be a Jew. And otherwise, Mordechai being in the Chatzar HaMelech, he seems to have achieved success or modicum of success or whatever level of success he's achieved as a royal officer, nothing to do with his last name being Rothschild. Mordechai, HaYehudi. Okay. Now, based on this, Rav Meidan presents the idea that maybe Mordechai and Esther were, to a degree, estranged from their religion. Meaning, they identified as Jews, they knew they were Jewish, but how important was it to them? And when I go through Rav Ben Nun's arguments, this will be understood in an even more profound way. Now, I'm not going to go through Rav Meidan's entire analysis, but I'll just say this. He towards the end of his argument, he says, look, Adam nidon al shem sofo, that a person is judged based on how he's at the end. Certainly Mordechai, by the end of the Megillah, is, you know, Mordechai HaYehudi, as we know and love him. Okay? But maybe we have to get out of this idea, you know, this, what I call the art scroll imagery of Mordechai. I remember once, Rabbi Grunblatt, when he was giving a shiur in the Queen's Jewish Center about the four sons. So he talks about the Chacham, the Rasha, the Enya De'Elishol, the Tam and the Enya De'Elishol, and he says, you know, it's a little bizarre that we, you know, we have these images from all the, you know, the illustrated Haggadahs, that the Chacham is a, you know, guy, and he says, with the long gabard and this, you know, long beard, and the Rashi, he says, these aren't levels of intelligence, okay? They're levels of, how does he say? I'm sorry. It's not levels of intelligence. It's personalities, because the Rasha is no less a chacham than the chacham is. He just has a different attitude. Okay, so just I use the image of the Langabart that Rabbi Grunblatt used to describe the chacham there. To, you know, to this image of Mordechai. With the exception of one, which is like quasi, you know, it's just Jewish, traditional Jewish. But every frum, you know, illustration of Mordechai is a guy with a long gray beard. Okay, let's think logically for a second, rationally for a moment. How old was Mordechai? Okay, most likely he was around the same age as Esther. Esther is described as a Nara, you know, beautiful young lady. So Mordechai was probably her age. Now this idea... What? Because they're cousins. He, Esther, Bas Dodo, they're the same generation. Okay? And the way, I mean, the fact, Asher Lakach Lo Lavas, maybe he's a little older than her. Okay? He raised her. He took care of her. You know, but you'll forgive me, and I'll talk about this at the end. But, you know, one of the quotes that I saw in one of these articles post this Itamar story, which I'm sure we all, you know, I'm it's devastated my week. I mean, I can't, is this 12-year-old girl saying, I will be a mother to her, you know, to her siblings. Okay? You know, they're the same generation. She's 12. One of them is, I don't remember, one's 4, one's 2, and one's 8, the other two. So, you know, I mean, it's not that far off to suggest that he's raising her, but he's not that much older than her. Esther, I mean, talking Mordechai and Esther now. Okay. So how old is Mordechai? Now, Asher Haglam Yerushalayim Hagalah Asher Aglasa would imply that Mordechai was exiled, but it's not Mordechai who was exiled.
20 years older than my first
cousin,
by the way.
Okay, fine. So 20 years. Fine, 20 years.
So she's saying that the Langa Bard is in
effect. I'm just saying, aren't that the same age? I'm saying there could be a 20-year gap.
Fine, so even a 20-year gap. Even a 20-year gap. How old is Esther?
She's 12.
Is she 60?
No, she's 12.
Is he 80? No. Okay, to think that Mordechai exiled from Jerusalem... It's not referring to Mordechai, it's referring to one of his ancestors. We're told 4 generations of Mordechai's family. So to say that Mordechai is the guy who exiled from Jerusalem, depending on how you understand the story, it's either close to the end of the 70 years exile, or 20 to 30 years afterwards. So it's not Mordechai who was exiled from Jerusalem, it's one of his ancestors who was exiled from Jerusalem. Mordechai was born into this culture. Mordechai was born in these environments. Esther was born in these environments. Look at their names. Mordechai and Esther, their names of pagan gods. And if that's the case, you know, I mean, maybe we're introduced, the first time we introduced her, she's called Esther, Hadassah, right, a Hebrew name. But otherwise, they're given these Persian names. So, who are these people? What's their story? What's their background? What's their identity as Jews? What's their relationship to God? Okay, when I get to Rabbi Nun's article, yeah, this will be all played out. He said, Adam nidon al shem sofo, that a person is judged based on their ends. Certainly by the end of the Megillah, Mordechai is presented as this gadol ha-yehudim v'ratzu l'rov v'chav, right? He's the bastion of Jewish heritage and Jewish light and Jewish life that he is transmitting to his Jewish brethren. But let's look at him in comparison to another great Jewish leader, Moshe Rabbeinu. What's Moshe's background? Yeah, he's nursed by his Jewish mother.
What if the
Okay? But he's brought up as an Egyptian. The one day he goes out as a Jew, he goes out, he kills an Egyptian. Next day he sees two Jews fighting. He says, what do I need this for? And he gets lost. He leaves. And then he goes to Midian. And in Midian, right, eventually he marries the daughter of Yisro, a pagan guy, priest, if ever there was one. He names his first son Gershom, saying, Gera Yisib Eretz Nachriya, I was a stranger in a strange land, right? Implying, I am not now. The first way in which he identifies to the daughters of Yisro is as an Ish Mitzri. Every midrash about Moshe's length of time in Midian is that he's in Midian for at least 40 years, if not 60 years, if not longer. And the midrashim abound about Mordechai, that he was a leader in Midian, that he took care of the people, that he was a king, that he was a minister, that he was a priest, whatever that he may have been. Right? And in Midian, he takes care of the daughters of Yisro, his wife, Yisro's animals. Right? There is no connection at all that Moshe has to the people in Egypt. There's even a whole discussion, and I think I talked about this once here, about Moshe's relationship with his father-in-law and any agreement they may have made about the circumcision of the sons. Right? That there wasn't a circumcision of Gershom. And you know, who's the son who's being circumcised in the hotel story? So, you know, it goes either way. It's either Gershom or Eliezer. But the point is, it's at that point that Moshe's identity is being sealed in the other direction. It's only after the burning bush that Moshe finally says, you know what? I'm going to be God's shepherd. I've had my good training to be a shepherd, but now I'm going to be God's shepherd for these people. When Moshe commits his heart and soul to the people, and then he becomes Moshe Rabbeinu. But it's only the last third of his life. The first two-thirds of his life have essentially nothing to do with the Jewish people. And that's why Adam Nidon al Shem Sofo. So Mordechai, now we can look at Mordechai as the guy with the long beard, fine. But Mordechai in the Megillah, until the end of the story, who is this guy? Who is him? Who is he? We don't know. We only know that he's a person who's really looking to get to a high point, and maybe he felt he didn't need to bow down to Haman. Firstly, because I outrank you, dude. I'm not, you know, there's no reason why I would bow down to you. Just as the king is not bowing down to you, I'm not bowing down to you. I outrank you. And then if that doesn't work for you, well, I have something else, by the way, and that's my ace in the hole, which is, I'm a Yehudi. Well, what does that mean? What does that mean? And in Rav Meidan's conclusion, he says, it's clear, on the one hand, that Mordechai and Esther, to whatever degree, they're as Jews. They're not idolaters. They haven't gone off the cliff in that direction. But they were not all that into their Judaism either. Even if Mordechai asked people not to go to a party, and that's, by the way, the culture that they're in. Even if it's true that Mordechai didn't ask people to go to the party, and there's no indication of that in the Megillah itself, well, did the people listen to him? No. So if the people didn't listen to him, so we see that the crowd in which they find themselves is not one which is all that committed to Judaism as we like to imagine it and envision it, you know, and certainly in the words of the rabbis. So when you look at Mordechai and Esther in the story, until, you know, before the end, they're living in a culture in which they're embedded in the society trying to get up. But there's one thing which they hold on to, and that is what I'll call, it's not my term, of course, the Pintel Yid, if you will, which says that there's some things that as a Jew, I don't do. Okay? I'm not bowing down to you. Whatever you represent, Haman, I'm not bowing down to you. You're not a king, bottom line. If you're a king, I'll bow down to you, because you're a king. But you're not a king, so I'm not bowing down to you. And if you have this idolatry either in your own essence as a person, you view yourself as an idol, or if it's in your clothing, you view it as an idol, I'm not bowing down to you. Why? I'm a Jew. And I'm sure we all know people like that who will say, there are some things that I don't do because I'm a Jew. I don't do anything else in Judaism. Nothing else. Maybe I don't know about it. Maybe I don't care about it. But as a Jew doesn't do that. Okay, and we'll get into that in a little more now as I present the other half of today's class, which is the article in that book written by Rav Yoel Ben-Nun. So Rav Yoel Ben-Nun's article is entitled Megillat HaHefech. Okay, or Megillat HaHafuch, something like that. The upside down, or the turned over, or the backwards Megillah. I'm going to share with you a few of the problems which he presents vis-a-vis this story insofar as how it fits in the Tanakh. But we know that the Megillah is probably, with the exception, I guess, of Ezra and maybe Divrei Ezra Nechemia, and maybe Divrei Hayamim, Megillah is one of the last books, and only because of how far Divrei Hayamim goes, is one of the last books of the canon of Tanakh that was put in there. Why is it there? Okay, so Rabbi Nun presents a number of arguments. He says, there's no evidence of what he calls Shem Shemayim. So obviously we know that the name of God doesn't appear, but the concept of Shem Shemayim, in other words, that godliness is also absent. When Mordechai tells Esther, "You have to go to the king and talk to him," he tells her, "If you don't go to the king, maybe Revach v'Hatzalah Yamod LaYudim Mimakom Acher." But what does Mimakom? That the salvation of the Jews will come from some other place. Now, you want to be a frum guy, you'll say, or a frum gal, sorry. I don't know my crap. Yeah, you'll say, no, Hamakom refers to God. Mimakom Acher, right? We say, Hamakom Yinachem Ischem, Hamakom Yirachem Aleinu, right? That the Makom refers to God. But it doesn't refer to God. That's not what Mordechai is talking about. He's saying it's either you or it's going to be somebody else. Mimakom Acher. That's number one. Number two.
So that's illustrating a lack of godliness?
Yeah. He's saying, if it's not you, Esther, some other person will step up and take charge, but you're the one who's in the best position to do something.
But that still indicates a lot of language, Your Honor.
Okay,
not to third grade, to language.
Right.
I've read that a million times, and every time I read it, it reads like someone of emunah. It does.
Fair enough. You also have preconceived ideas of the Megillah, and I'm presenting things which perhaps go against your preconceived notions.
Right. So,
it's very difficult to look at a book like the Megillah from a fresh perspective and say, let me consider a new idea, because we know it so well.
I hear what you're saying. Okay, I hear what you're saying. Got it.
Okay.
Right.
But the next one's going to be an even better proof for you.
Is the other proof
with the fasting before the Right. Says, Sumu Alai. You must have read it. Sumu Alai, he says, Sumu Alai, fast for me. What about tefillah? What about tachanunim? What about asking? What about, gather the people? What does it mean, gather? What are they going to do when they gather? Sumu, just add one word. His palalu, whatever, his, this chananu, something. I mean, just pray. There's no concept of prayer.
What does fasting do then?
It's a connection to something, right? Ask anybody who's not observant in any which way, why do you fast on Yom Kippur? Ask them why. You fast on Yom Kippur. That's why. Right. Now, I remember my brother works in some office where he's got some Jewish coworkers who said, "Oh, I was fasting yesterday. Thank God I was able to drink." And he's like, "No, that's not how it works. No, it's, you don't even drink. You don't even brush your teeth. How do you do that?" So that's what they were doing. No, they have a connection to something. I'm not right. It's a connection, exactly. Okay,
they're connected.
Right. I'm not knocking here. I'm just presenting a new idea. Okay, but not only that, though. Not only that. Let's look at the calendar. Haman's edict goes out on the 13th day of Nisan. You have, let's say she gets to that day. She says, starting tomorrow, we're going to have a 3-day fast. 14th, 15th, 16th. Now, let's be realistic for a moment, okay? This decree is for 11 months from now. Does it matter if we fast today, tomorrow, the day after, and go to the king? Or can it wait 2 days? Even if they didn't have Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios, okay? Can it wait 1 day? I mean, come on! You fast on Pesach, why? Because you have no concept of what it means to have a Seder. This is supposed to be Chayrus and freedom. Is it that? If Haman's decree is we're going to kill you tomorrow, okay, fine. Horasha, obviously, you fast now. But if his decree is 11 months away, what are you fasting now? And on Pesach yet? Why? Where does that come from? So I'm presenting 6 more things about the lack of godliness in the Megillah, or at least what he calls again the upside down nature of the Megillah.
Upside down.
There's no mention of the concept of schar ve'onesh. Why is the decree being written? In other words, did the Jews deserve this? You know, usually when something happens, you know, you see the vayov du es elohe achi, you know, elohim achirin, the people, they worship other gods, and so God sends up. You know, you get an idea, a concept, why an evil king or an evil, you know, dictator or some guy comes along and oppresses the Jewish people. There's no mention of anything like that in the Megillah. It's happened because it happened, because somebody didn't like the Jews. Why? We have no idea. There's no mention of the problem, and I mentioned this before, of a Nahara Yehudiya, a Jewish girl, being brought to the palace, right, to spend 6 months in a bath of Shemen Hamor and 6 months in a bath of spices. I mean, what is that? What kind of life is that? There's no explanation for why Mordechai won't bow beyond Kihu Yehudi, which I mentioned before, and when there's no, you see, there's no prohibition to bow to a human. There's no classic example or reason for the anti-Semitism. The only thing that is presented from Haman as to why, you know, to, and from Haman to Achashverosh, to why he wants to get rid of the people, I talked about this last week, is that Tehem Shonos Mikolam is the same Elchin Amosim. Right? They have different laws, and they don't follow the king's laws. Examples? I mean, there's no. Give me something else. Explain. Give me one example of a law of the king that they don't follow. One example. Something. Right? There's no rhyme or reason. Just general. Generalizations which have no basis or support. There's no explanation for why Haman can't defeat the Jews. Remember when Zeresh comes to Haman after Haman has taken Mordechai through the streets? She says, "Oh, wait a second! If you didn't mention in Mizera Hiudim Mordechai Asher Achilos Lempolofan Alosuchal Lo, if Mordechai's a Jew, well, yeah, man, it's not going to work." Why? Where does that come from? What is it about the Jews that makes them immune to Haman's level of punishment? Or whatever it is that Haman's trying to do? Why is it that just because they're Yehudim, all of a sudden, they're going to get a free pass and somehow they're going to survive what you're trying to do? No, in other words, if you are devout and if you're faithful, the fact that Zeresh says, "Imi Zera Yehudim," should be based on something. What is her experience that the Jews get to, you know, have God protecting them? She doesn't even say God's going to protect them.
Why is she saying? I thought she's saying that you're going to get them anyway.
No, she says, "Nafolti polifanav," you're going to fall. You're not going to have a chance. This is after Haman has walked through, right? It's one of the beautiful contrasts in the Megillah, where the first time Haman comes to Zeresh, it's Vayomrelu Al Hava, right? All of his beloved people, they say, "Build a tree, you'll hang Mordechai."
Right.
Then Perek Vav takes place, where Haman comes to Achashverosh, and Achashverosh says, "Okay, you want me to honor a person that way, so you're going to do that to Mordechai." And then he comes back home, and he tells them the whole story and how you know, whatever took place. Vayomrelu. Vayamru lo chachamav is Eresh Ishto. It's the end of Perek Vav. Vayamru lo chachamav. They're no longer Ohavav, his beloved. Now they're his wife. Right now they have a distance.
Oh wait, it says Vayamru lo chachamav.
That's his perspective.
Okay.
Oh, so they're no longer
okay.
Right, they're no longer Ohavav. They're like, no. We are not your Ohavav anymore, man. We see where you're going. You're going down the river without a paddle. Vayamru lo chachamav is Eresh Ishto. Imizera yudim Mordechai shirchilos and polofanav lo suchal lo. You're not going to be able to beat him, kina faulty pole of an up, because you're going to fall in front of him. You're a dead man, Haman. You're done. You're finished. We see where you're going. And so, but why? Based on what? What is Zeresh talking about? What evidence is there to suggest from anything that's been presented in the Megillah that these Yehudim get a free pass, that they're going to win? It you know.
Why does it switch from Ohavav to Chachamav?
That's the Hefech, you know, the Vanafohu and the Megillah.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I mean, if I have time, I'll get into that. I don't know if I'll have time today to do that.
Can I quickly go to your previous one about the decrees? Perhaps Haman is saying, because the decree to bow down was from the king. To bow down to Haman came from the king.
It could be.
He could be saying,
it could
just
be.
Like they won't follow this decree, they're not following
it could
any
be.
Of your decrees.
You're right, only vis-a-vis Mordechai. Because it's only Mordechai who's not bowing down.
Right.
And Haman's choice to destroy all the Jewish people is because he has a vendetta against one guy.
Right.
And the Megillah even tells us that the only reason why he doesn't get rid of the one guy with Achashverosh's permission, his vayivas be'inav l'shloach yad Mordechai l'avodah. It's embarrassing. How are you going to go? I think I presented this last week. Right? Imagine Haman goes over to Achashverosh. Achashverosh, listen, there's a royal officer who's not bowing down to me. Who is it? It's Mordechai. Come on, Mordechai! Mordechai saved my life, Haman. Are you kidding? Leave Mordechai alone.
He has no other way to get
him. Exactly. So he has no other way to get into him without embarrassing himself, without saying, "Let's kill all the Jews." Okay, but again, that's a different discussion. Right now, you know, just from the perspective of the Jewishness of the Megillah, it's not apparent. Okay, there's no mention of Eretz Yisrael or Yerushalayim. Mm-hmm. What's going on? The current events, only the past. That once upon a time, Mordechai had an ancestor who came from Jerusalem. And while the people are there, they've gone back. This is after Koresh has said, you guys can come back and begin building the temple. And there's no mention of that. And finally, he says, the problem with just in terms of the way the Megillah presents, Achashverosh, who is this guy Achashverosh? What we see of him is that he likes parties, he likes women, but there's no real insight into his character or to his place in history. If Achashverosh is this king over 127 countries, right, the only indication of anything regarding Achashverosh outside of this ridiculous farce of a story, which is the Megillah, is Hu Achashverosh Hamalech Me'od Be'Akush Sheva Ve'Esrim Me'Yav Medina. Right? That he has 127 countries? That's the first verse in the Megillah. And then the last three psukim in the Megillah is Achashverosh gets back to foreign policy and he establishes a tax over ala aris v'iye hayam, over the land and the islands, and then Mordechai is his chief advisor. That's it. As far as Achashverosh, in all the 9 years that we see Achashverosh in this Megillah, the Megillah doesn't present anything in terms of how he related to his subjects, how he related to the Jewish subjects, how he related to anything else beyond his parties and his women and this crazy story.
Yes.
Do we know? I mean, not from the Megillah. We know from the Megillah, it begins in his third year and it begins in his 12th year. If there's other indication of Achashverosh, I don't believe Achashverosh is mentioned anywhere else in Tanakh. There are other kings who are mentioned, and people try to identify Achashverosh as one of them, like Artaxasta.
Confessions in Ezra, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Vav. It says his name, mm-hmm. Achashverosh.
Okay, right, but there may have been other Achashverosh's also. Okay, I mean, I'm not denying what you're saying, right? So, but who is he? People don't know. I mean, there are debates. There are debates. Was he Xerxes? Was he, you know, which? If he was Xerxes, which one was he? Okay, and other you know topics of discussion. But in the Megillah itself, nothing. Okay. So, Rav Ben Nun asks, why does the Megillah basically paint what he calls a chiloni picture of the Jews in this place? And he says, and that's why he calls it Megillat HaEfech, or Megillat HaEfech, that it's the opposite, it's the contrast to the rest of the Tanakh. Everything else in Tanakh is about Malchus Shemayim, right? It's about God and the relationships that people create in Adam LaMakom, right, between man and God. Here, it's the opposite. You have the participation in the party of Achashverosh. You have Mordechai and Esther who are successful in the kingdom and the empire of Malchut Paraz Umadai. Esther has a Hebrew name, yeah, but we don't hear about it except for once to just say, by the way, you know, she's Jewish. And Mordechai, of course, is, you know, as I think I've mentioned, Ishtar and Marduk, pagan gods. There is no...
Mordechai doesn't have a Hebrew name.
Right, saying that, but and there's no right. There's no concept of hashgachas Hashem, the God's watching over anyway. Everything is poor goral, lottery, luck of the draw. Esther, it worked out. Oh, it's the right timing. Haman happens to be at the time when they're reading about Mordechai and Achashverosh says to him, "But what I do to the guy I want to honor?" And at that point in time, Achashverosh specifically is having negative thoughts about Haman because of the party which took place with Esther that day. And so Haman comes in and says, "This is what you do to the guy you want to honor. Oh, it just happened to be that he was there." And so therefore Achashverosh says, "Do it, Lemordechai." And it's interesting that Achashverosh says, "Lemordechai, ha-Yehudi," right? Because up until that point in time, you know, it's interesting. By the way, take a look in Perek Vav.
But that's a truism.
Hold on.
No.
Well, no, he says that. But hold on. Okay. Vayimatzei chasuv. Pasuk Beis. Perek Vav. 1257. Pasuk Beis. It says, what was written in Achashverosh's book? Right, throughout most of this Megillah. Sometimes he's called Mordechai. Sometimes he's called Mordechai Yehudi. What's written in Achashverosh's book? Asher, higid Mordechai. Not Hayudi. He gave Mordechai Albik, son of a Seresh. Right? That's the way Mordechai is. It was presented to Achashverosh, but Achashverosh knows that Haman is, you know, that he is a little bit of an anti-Semite, and he wants to knock Haman down, and that's why he says to Haman, "Vayomer Hamelech leHaman." Pasuk Yud, towards the bottom of the page, he says, "Asechein leMordechai." Bad enough, Mordechai, because I know you don't like Mordechai. Hi, Yehudi, Haman. He sticks it into his face to say, Haman, you're going to have to do something for this Jew. Did Achashverosh care that Mordechai was a Jew? Seemingly not. It didn't matter to him then. Why should it matter to him now? Achashverosh is apathetic towards Jews. Doesn't matter one way or another. Are you a good royal officer? Are you a good accountant? Are you a good foreign policy? You know, do you do. Now, what is it that you do? You bring something, that's why I employ you. You're not employed, then I either can you or I kill you. That's the way I operate here. Doesn't matter to me.
No one ever says that Anshei Knesset HaGadol are giving us a remez. This is not something I learned in school. That, like, yeah, listen, you're going to live as an outsider in a land, but you'll always be known as the Jew. I mean, you don't think that they're, like, giving us that subtle hint?
Right.
Even in this country, you know.
It could be. And that's along the lines of the conclusion that Rav Yol mentions. I want to share with you his language at the end, so mm-hmm. you'll get it. Because it, again, relates, as I said at the outset, to current events. Okay? Right, and he says it's more than likely that Haman, who is into lotteries, Goralot, right, that Haman is doing everything based on how the dice turn, how the whatever the magic, sorcery, witchcraft of his time will indicate to him. And what's the only change in Haman's plan? Is that at the critical moment, the guy who's supposed to end up hanging from a tree mm-hmm. ends up being the wrong guy.
Tree or gallows?
Whatever. It's called an ace. I keep on calling it a tree. It's called an ace. And it's a wooden gallows. Yeah, it is a gallows. He's not building a tree in one night. He's building a gallows. Okay? I call it a tree just because the language is ace. So he compares, just one more general comparison, but with a lot of details, is the odd nature of the palace of the king and Esther's role versus the palace of the King of Kings and the lead role there. You have in Achashverosh's palace, you have the Chatzer HaChitzonah and the Chatzer HaPanimis, which Esther goes into. Whoever goes into the Chatzer HaPanimis without being called, the inner court without being called, is killed. In the Beis HaMikdash, you also have, and he quotes Yechezkel Mem Yedzayin. Yeah. He quotes, and he says in the Beis HaMikdash also, you had a Chatzer HaChitzon and the Chatzer HaPanimis as well. And similarly, in that Chatzer HaPanimis, which is the Kodesh HaKodeshim, you're not allowed to go into without dying unless you're called. And who's called? Just the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. And that is the parallel to the Chatzer HaPanimis.
That Esther was called?
Right. That Esther was, that you, no, she wasn't called, but you can't, Levad Asher Yoshidla HaMelech, in other words, you have to be called in order, right? And maybe the fact that Esther's fasting, or he doesn't mention that, but that's a good call. The fact that Esther's fasting when she's going in, right? Isn't that fascinating? And you have a king who sees himself as the king of the world versus God, who of course is the king of the world. The difference between Esther, how she walks into that Chatzer HaPanimis versus the Kohen Gadol when he walks in. What's Esther? She's a Malkah, she's an Isha, and she's wearing Bigdei Malchut, royal clothing, versus the Kohen Gadol, who's obviously not an Isha, who's a guy who's given this position simply because, he earned it he earned the stripe in some way, but otherwise, the Kohen Gadol? Not necessarily. Okay? And what does he wear going in? Just the big day lavan when he goes, just the white clothing, the white garments, none of the gold. The gold doesn't go into the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Okay? He wears that. And the Kohen Gadol has two important entries to the Kodesh HaKodeshim, or two at least important types of entries to the Kodesh HaKodeshim. One, when he puts the ketores, the spices on the burning hot coals to fill the room with smoke, and second one is to take the blood and sprinkle it inside the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Those are the two types of entries which he has, which are important into the Kodesh HaKodeshim. The other entry that he has is to take the shovel out. So that's not important. It's just that he needs to go in there to get what he left there. And Esther also has two important entries where she talks to the king. Not to the Chatzer HaPnimis, but one where she tells the king, that this guy Haman is the bad guy, and the other one where, after he hasn't gotten rid of the decree, where she literally goes down on her feet, to say, king, get rid of this decree which you haven't gotten rid of yet. And the king, he doesn't get rid of it, but he gives Mordechai the means to get rid of it. And his conclusion is, Rabbi Elbanan's conclusion is, that God's hashgacha can also be found in places and situations that are distant from Kedusha. In other words, the life that is lived in this time, or at least as it's presented in this time of the Megillah, is a time where the concept of Kedusha, holiness, seems to be absent. The concept of getting close to God seems to be not a focus of the story. And nonetheless, the Jew emerges, right? Mordechai is not going to bow down on account of the fact that he's a Jew. Esther can stand up to the king and say, listen, you got to help me because I'm a Jew. What does it mean to you? We don't know. We don't know anything about their religious experience. We know that they have, a peace. I don't bow down. I fast when I need to. But other than that, the Megillah doesn't present. But at the end of the Megillah, we see the focus on Yehudim, 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 Yehudi, 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 and that Esther and Mordechai send out, and as Rav Meidan said, that a person is Nidon al Shem Sofo. In other words, what's their end? And if their end is that they came back to whatever it was, right? Kimu v'kibalu ayudim, which is what's written in the Megillah, the Gemara tells us, Kimu v'kibalu means that they re-accepted the Torah, which seems to imply the possibility that those who were living in this time had rejected it, had said, you know what, that's not the life that I need to live anymore. That's not the life which is for me. And that's, his perspective in terms of the lesson that could be taken from the Megillah. Is it true that Mordechai and Esther, let's say, were not observant Jews? Doesn't matter. The point is, the way that the Megillah is being presented is a way which can be related to Jews, hopefully, of all colors and stripes. And the way in which I view this as being just related to our current events and the horrible, horrific, disgusting, event which took place in Itamar this past Shabbos is the idea that, I hope, I don't know, because there are people, unfortunately, in many cases, Jews are our own worst enemies. The approach that says that, oh sure, suicide bombings and terrorism are legitimate because of the occupation. It's one thing if Arabs say that, because we know where they come from. But it's when the Jews who say that say, no, maybe this isn't the best way, but it's justified because the Jews are, you look at this and you say, no, I hope that everybody can understand that we are not dealing with a normal other side. That we're dealing with, my line this week is to call whoever does this an animal is an insult to an animal. We're talking about monsters. I mean, that's really what we're dealing with. And my hope is, in my prayer, and what the message that I take just from this presentation of the Megillah now, is that we hope that all Jewish people can seek out that Pinta L'Yid and say, no matter what else I think in terms of my politics or my worldview or whatever, I have to recognize where wrong is wrong and where evil is evil. Haman was the same guy in Itamar, right? What's Haman? We're going to kill Tach Vinashim, right? Kol Yudim. Men, women, children, B'yom Echad, we don't care what they've accomplished, what they do, it doesn't matter. That's Haman. Sick, worse than sick. Based on what? Because they're Jews. That's it. And that's what's taking place. That's what takes place in a circumstance like this in Itamar. Why? A person sleeping? A baby? You're going to go? Why? Because they're Jews. Ah, and Shkayach, you've accomplished a lot. You can slit a baby's throat. You can stab somebody in the heart who's 4 years old, who's eight, whatever it is, who's 11 years old. Oh, you're a big gibor. Ezehu gibor, right? Big. And it's just, it's tremendously painful, as I'm sure everybody, I'm looking around the room, and everybody, I know we're all on the same page. And it's my hope and prayer that it's this message of the Megillah can reach those Jews who perhaps don't get it yet, or maybe now they can tweak their mind and look from the other side which is the correct side, which says that the attitude which comes from those who view that as normal is a different planet, and there's no room for that in our world. Jews need to band together so that we can fight against the Hamans in our midst. and rid them from our midst so that we can live the lives that we need to in freedom and in peace with those who recognize that good people of the world are good people and can live in peace and harmony when they respect everyone else's right to exist.